It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk Colbert. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk. Well, you know, there were some interesting things that happened in a Michigan courtroom.
I heard about this.
Yes, a very furious judge lashed out at a woman who had been convicted of murder, of first-degree homicide. It was actually a very brutal type situation where there were multiple stab wounds and this, I believe, was her boyfriend. And so they had the sentencing phase in this case. And the judge, by the way, had no discretion in terms of what he was able to do.
So it was basically just an opportunity for everybody to lash out at this
defendant.
You know, hey, because the sentence is already predetermined based on the crime.
The sentence is predetermined. It is life in prison without the possibility of parole. And that is the offense that she was convicted of, first-degree murder. So during the sentencing hearing, as you and I know, in most sentencing hearings, there are, if somebody is convicted of a crime and there's a victim, the victim or his or her family is allowed to speak. And so there was one particular woman who was speaking on behalf of the victim, of this man who was killed. And in the middle of that, the defendant, this woman, was sort of rolling her eyes and smirking and doing all kinds of things that were, I mean, I think
probably inappropriate.
Inappropriate.
But again, probably doesn't matter, right?
Probably doesn't matter, but inappropriate. So then she then interrupts the woman who's speaking. And at this point, the judge had enough. And he yelled from the bench at her. And he also said, "I hope you die in prison." Because the family members were talking about how the justice was that she was going to serve out the rest of her days in prison and that she was going to die there. And this judge just screamed at her and said, "I hope you die in prison." And then he also said, "And you stabbed, and you stabbed, and you stabbed." I mean, he was very, very animated.
Yes.
In a way that, you know, and you can...
Some might call it inappropriate.
Might call it inappropriate, but you can... He said, "You gutted him like a fish in that apartment. You were relentless." And he goes on. And so this was a very heated thing. It instantly went viral. The video you can find, I'm sure, anywhere online. And the question becomes, was this appropriate or not? And what does a judge, how can a judge react in a sentencing hearing like this?
Well, I think it would matter a lot more if there was some discretion on the part of the judge and the judge was showing some form of animus that was not, you know, appropriate under the circumstances. But let's be clear, judges are allowed and should have a reaction to the crime. I mean, you know, sometimes that involves anger. Sometimes that involves expressing the community's views. And really all this judge was doing was echoing what somebody else had said, that that's an appropriate sentiment. And, you know, people are making a big deal out of the specific wording because he says, "I hope you die," which sounds like something you'd say on the, you know, on the playground when you're in third grade and you say, "I hope you die," you know, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I think that's where people have a problem.
A little immature or something, you know?
If you would have said, "You're going to die in prison."
Which is true,
by the way. True, right?
Yeah, it's just
but
a fact.
"I hope you die in prison" could suggest that you're hoping that somebody inside of the prison
kills you.
Yeah. Right. So it's almost like
a little more than you're just simply going to die in prison someday. It means it implies sooner rather than later.
Sooner rather than later. Yeah. And it's like the Jeffrey Dahmer situation. Now, I remember, do you remember when he actually was killed in prison?
Yes.
I mean, I remember exactly what I was doing, where I was and all of that. That it was not exactly surprising, but there was a broomstick involved.
Oh,
it was a horrible situation. And you know what? A lot of people applauded that, and no one in their right mind would ever defend Jeffrey Dahmer's actions. I mean, what he did was absolutely horrendous beyond belief, you know, chopping people up and, you know, cutting them open and all kinds of horrendous acts that, by the way,
storing them in barrels for later use.
That, by the way, is not your common scenario,
right?
Even when it comes to homicide. I mean,
but somebody being killed by another inmate is not justice.
It's not justice.
That's not part of how our system works, and nobody would allow that to happen if they could prevent it, or they shouldn't anyway.
Yeah, it's vigilante justice is what it is.
Right. So,
if you can call that justice.
You know, I'm not too bent out of shape by this judge's comments for two reasons. One is that it was a foregone conclusion. His attitude really didn't matter. It wouldn't have made any difference with regard to, you know, justice, so to speak, if the judge had said, gee, I think you're a nice lady and you know, you're a great mom and you serve the community well, but gosh, the law requires you to serve the rest of your life.
Well, he's not going to say that.
Of course he's not going to say that, because those things weren't true. But on the other hand, if he really was just merely repeating what somebody else had already said, and you know, he got a little bit too into it. He didn't give the impression that he was, you know, standing in an objective sort of sense. But the other reason I don't have a problem with it is that, again, I've heard judges say much worse things to defendants that show, you know, a complete lack of a willingness to stand as the referee in these types of things. And you and I have worked on several cases where, you know, fortunately nothing here in Sheboygan County, but in other counties in the state where some judges just, you wonder what's going on in their head, and they take almost a personal interest in being involved in exacting some sort of vengeance on behalf of
a victim. A judge shows that, sometimes you and I have seen a judge showing that type of demeanor even before somebody's been had their chance, had their day in court, had their trial. They're assuming that they're going to be convicted, and that can be troubling too, because then you wonder about the rest of, okay, is this judge going to be fair with my client? I mean, that's what you want. You want fairness, and you need that from a jury. You need that from a judge. You need judges to be impartial. But what's the worst thing that could possibly happen after somebody's been convicted of first-degree intentional homicide and they're sitting in a courtroom? And I mean, and they start rolling their eyes and smirking and laughing as members of the victim's family are speaking. I mean, that is about the worst thing that you could do,
right?
To anger the judge.
Let's put it this way. She was going to get life in prison without parole no matter how she acted or what her response was.
So it didn't matter.
So the only difference is the judge could politely tell her that she's going to spend the rest of her life in prison, or he could angrily tell her. So, you know, if she has some degree of control over the judge's response by acting like a jerk in response to people's victims' statements, I suppose the only additional measure of punishment that the judge could hand out is to inform her of her sentence in a slightly more brutal way.
Well, he said he was going to bind and gag her with duct tape.
Well, that's
but
because she was misbehaving.
They went through the courthouse and they couldn't find any duct tape.
So, yeah, that's...
They're like going up to the custodial worker. They're like, do you have duct tape? No, I don't have
note
duct tape.
To self. Judge Rowe, note to self. Next hearing, make sure we have ample duct tape on hand.
Get duct tape.
Get duct tape.
Or some other
list of things to do today. Number one, get duct tape.
I've never had that experience of one of my clients being duct taped.
I had a client that almost, he very, very close from a judge that has a very low-key demeanor. So it was
surprising.
This particular client was pushing things right to that envelope, and
he
had trouble restraining himself. But you know, another thing that kind of bothers me about this, although I think that there's nothing, you know, blatantly inappropriate about the judge's comments, but couldn't this also be viewed as an opportunity for someone who holds, let's face it, a political office to get some popular
press
support, and after all, we're talking about it right now on the radio. This video went viral.
There are
people out there that are going to say this judge is awesome because he really let her have it, you know.
That bothers me a little bit. Well, and that's unfortunate in the sense that you always kind of there sometimes with some situations you can sense a different reaction when there is press, when there is media inside of the courtroom from certain judges. And that's, to me, I suppose that's part of human nature. On the other hand, you would hope it wouldn't happen because you're hoping that regardless of the media attention in the case,
The judge would be just as careful about selecting the words that are said. And that's true. But maybe that's, you know, this my sentiments on this issue kind of go back and forth because the reality is, we, as many jurisdictions in this country, do have a justice system that incorporates a political element. And I don't mean political parties. I mean there is a method by which people become judges. In our state, it's through elections, just like you're running for mayor or senator or anything else.
But they're supposed to be nonpartisan.
And they are supposed to be nonpartisan.
Right.
But the point is that, you know, there is a more or less popular vote out there, and people run against each other, and the populace, the general public, picks who they want to be the judge. And most people that aren't familiar with the intricacies and complexities of the justice system probably would prefer to see the tough judge get elected. That's just kind of a common view. Those of us within the legal system, and it's not just because I'm a defense lawyer, but I think most of us would prefer to see somebody who's level-headed, can deal with difficult situations, can restrain their emotions, because we don't want emotion to be part of how a judge reacts to things. And I don't mean completely emotionless, but I mean being aware of somebody's emotions, being aware of the controversy, and being level-headed. And being judicious. That's what that word means.
Even-handed. Right. Yeah. All right. We have to take a break. We'll be back with more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey in just a moment.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Well, welcome back to Legal Defense. And, you know, Kirk, there was a rare, what they're calling, Perry Mason moment.
I have those all the time.
Yes. And this is from this is from the ABA Journal's website. It says, rare Perry Mason moment in court wins dismissal for defendant, desk duty for five police officers. A seemingly routine suppression hearing in a suburban Chicago courthouse last month took an unexpected dramatic turn when video from a police car was introduced that disproved the testimony of five police officers. They had said that Joseph Sperling was arrested after officers who pulled him over in a traffic stop smelled marijuana, searched the vehicle, and found nearly a pound in a backpack lying in the back seat of his car. But the Glenview police video showed the search occurred only after Sperling was taken from his car, frisked, and handcuffed, reports the Chicago Tribune. The newspaper dubbed it a Perry Mason moment rarely seen inside an actual courtroom, castigating the officers for the outrageous conduct, quote-unquote. Cook County Circuit Judge Catherine Habercorn granted a defense motion to suppress the search, which eliminated a basis for his arrest and resulted in a swift dismissal by prosecutors of the felony drug case. The judge said, quote, all the officers lied on the stand today, actually used those words. She herself, this judge, is a former prosecutor, and at the hearing she said, so there was strong evidence it was a conspiracy to lie in this case for everyone to come up with the same lie. The officers were later put on desk duty as investigators of their conduct proceeded. Now, this is the type of thing.
Well, and that makes sense because they're much less likely to lie sitting at a desk in the police department, right? What were they doing? Drafting reports?
Exactly. You know, this
with
is
lies.
And by the way, they're you know, these officers who did that, they stand in a position of trust in the community. Many people trust them to do justice. They have a lot of power in what they do. They have a lot of power to arrest people. That's an incredible power that you have. These particular police officers should, in my view, not only be fired,
prosecuted. Sure.
Because
perjury.
They perjured. They absolutely perjured them. And the judge even – it's rare, by the way, that a judge uses the word lie in conjunction with a police officer.
Even if some judges believe that, they often don't use that particular word.
Well, I'm not sure that's exactly what happened here or something.
It appears
like that.
There's some inconsistency. That's usually the way it goes. We're not really sure what happened here, but, you know, blah, blah, blah.
But this judge actually said all the officers lied on the stand today and said there was evidence of a conspiracy. conspiracy. This is a former prosecutor, by the way. Okay, this is someone who used to be on the side of the prosecution.
Well, let's make sure I understand the issue, because the testimony was different than the video, is my understanding.
That's right.
And I'm assuming then the testimony was that the search of the vehicle was either consented to or occurred at a different point in time, which would have legal significance. So if the person's being hauled out of the car and handcuffed, based on what we know to be case law that requires the police to have more than just a search of the vehicle incident to arrest, because that was the old law that changed. Right. A couple of years ago in a case called Arizona versus Gant.
In that case, what I gather from that is, you know, basically now when police officers stop somebody, they pull somebody over, let's say they pull them out of the car, and they're going to arrest them for some particular reason. They got to arrest them on a warrant. Let's say it's an active warrant.
Or it's a speeding ticket or something
whatever,
like that.
Yeah.
The guy didn't have a valid license, whatever.
And they put him in the back seat of the squad car, and then they just search his car without anything
further. And that used to be allowed.
And
now it's
not. It's no longer allowed. Unless they have probable cause to believe that they will find evidence of the crime in the car.
The guy's already arrested for.
Right. And so I think that's most likely what happened in this circumstance. And now you have these five police officers, all of whom gave the same story. I assume they were probably sequestered, meaning the officers were out of the courtroom while the other officer was testifying.
Here's the really shocking thing, Casey. I believe there was a conspiracy to lie here. But if even one of those doofuses had, can I say that on the radio?
Sure.
Doofus?
Sure.
I'm not even sure what the dictionary definition of that is. But if one of these, even one of these doofuses had, is that the plural or is it doofi? Doofa.
Well, doofay. That's
if one of these doofay.
I'm going to have to consult the my dictionary.
If the plural of a doofus, if even one doofus had watched the video prior to going to court, which came from the police, by the way, they could have at least reminded themselves of what really happened. And they also would know that the defense lawyer has the recording if they were paying attention.
Right. Well, but doesn't this
so it's a combination of lying and incompetence.
This is an important and this is an important point, okay? To just take, you know, there could have been, and there's a lot of people who do this. Unfortunately, you know, you and I practice in an area, and I think that at our firm, we do very in-depth work on these types of things, and we're always requesting recordings and videos. And if you look at those things, a lot of times there is stuff in there, even if it's not a lie or something like that, okay? There's stuff in the video that isn't in the actual police report.
Sometimes
it happens all the time.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes they don't match up at all, and you wonder, where did this report come from?
And it may not. And by the way, to be fair, there are, you know, many honest police officers. There are some police officers who are less than truthful, okay? And so, and that's the same thing in any profession. There are honest lawyers and dishonest lawyers. So if you didn't have a lawyer in this case, if there wasn't, if the lawyer didn't take the time to look at the video, if the lawyer didn't take the time to file a motion to suppress evidence, this person who got pulled over could be sitting in jail or prison. I don't know the exact, but if he had a pound of marijuana, they could be charging him theoretically with delivery or
There are listeners right now that are thinking, Casey, so what? Because the guy had a pound of marijuana. Shouldn't he have been caught? Shouldn't he have gone to prison? Because after all, the guy was doing something bad, right?
Sir, if the Constitution doesn't matter, then yes. If you're saying the Constitution doesn't, I know you're not saying this, Kirk, but if somebody listening is saying the Constitution doesn't matter, the Fourth Amendment doesn't matter, there is a reason that we have the Fourth Amendment, because it protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. And it protects against the very scenario that we have here. An officer, and by the way, the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, says the Glenview arrest of Sperling last June came at the request of Chicago narcotics officers who had Sperling under surveillance. They asked local police to pull him over in a marked car, which occurred when Sperling allegedly failed to use his turn signal. He says he did. Then one of the officers testified he smelled marijuana as he waited for Sperling to produce his license and registration. Sperling testified he was never asked to do so. The officer, supported by testimony from four other Chicago and Glenview officers, said he ordered Sperling to exit his vehicle, stand by his trunk as he searched it. However, the video shows the search didn't occur until after Sperling was sitting handcuffed in a police car.
Right. And, so, and it has tremendous legal significance.
Tremendous.
So they changed the facts in order to support the search. And that the review of how the events occurred occurs obviously after the fact. And because an officer can't write a report as it's happening.
Right.
But you would think that with modern technology being such that it is, that it could be consulted so that they weren't lying. And this is a good thing. You know, we all have our concerns about the big brotherness of our society and how everywhere you go, you're under surveillance and, you know, every interaction you have with the world is somehow being monitored more and more so every day because of the existence of more advanced and cheaper technology everywhere. But this is one of those good effects of having technology that can document something in a way that does not come down to a subjective interpretation. Oftentimes, I explain to clients what they see in a police report because 9 out of 10 times when you're sitting down with somebody and saying, let's talk about what's in the police report, 9 out of 10 times they will say it didn't happen that way. Sometimes, and in the old days when we didn't have video and we didn't have ways to confirm things, you would have to say, well, that's too bad because it doesn't matter. It's your word against the cop, and the cop has control over the information. Well, now that we have more and more of an ability to test what really happened, it makes a difference. And it's supposed to and should keep cops honest. And that's a good thing. And most cops I know embrace that idea and think, good, you know, because this way nothing's going to be controversial. And most of the time when there's something being documented, if it's something that an officer is forming a subjective opinion about, sometimes this objective evidence can support that as well. Like if the officer says, boy, he really seemed like he was drunk. Well, what's that based on? Well, you know, he was unsteady on his feet. He was slurring his words. Without the video, you can wonder where that's coming from, or is it just motivated by a desire to get an arrest, or is it just going to be another basis for a future promotion of this officer, or whatever the case may be. When you got the video there, sometimes, you know, you can see with your own eyes what the officer was talking about. But like in this case, what should have happened here is that the police should have realized that they had a bad arrest. They should have told the prosecutor, by the way, that, hey, look, our report was wrong on this. It was an honest mistake. And then just left it at that and say, you should go ahead and dismiss this because we messed up.
Right, right. Absolutely.
But it didn't go that way. Now they're all on desk duty.
They're on desk duty. All right. Well, we have to take a break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Casey, would you spank me?
No. Kirk, I can't do that. And that would be...
Because if you did, I would report
child
abuse.
Child
I'm not
abuse.
A child, but, you know...
Well, you'd report adult abuse.
I would.
Just abuse.
I yes.
Is what we could call it. And, of course, we're not making light of abuse, actual abuse.
Right.
But the question becomes whether spanking a child is abuse. And there was a study that was done by the Canadian Medical Association Journal, and they surveyed 23,000 adult Canadians. 32% identified themselves as being victims of child abuse or exposed to violence by parents, step-parents, grandparents, or other adults in authority in their homes. And this person who writes on this website says, which would make me an abused child. Here's how. And this is what this this person goes on to say. When I was about 4 years old, I had beautiful long chestnut hair, which I hated to have washed. We had an old clawfoot.
Is this you talking or you're
no,
you're
this
reading?
Is not me. I'm reading.
Okay, because I didn't know you had beautiful long chestnut
no, this is
hair.
From the, this is from the Huffington Post.
I could see when that. Was, but anyway, go ahead.
When I was about 4 years old, I had beautiful long chestnut hair, which I hated to have washed. We had an old clawfoot bathtub and one of those old fashioned rubber showers that you stuck on the end of the bathtub faucet so you could rinse your hair. Usually,
sounds like a horror movie.
I know.
Already.
Usually, I would lean over the tub for the lather, rinse, repeat. It involved being a bit of a contortionist, but it avoided getting shampoo in my eyes. But on this day, I was in the tub getting my hair washed, and I was having an epic meltdown. I remember it vividly. My mother had folded a washcloth and was trying to hold it over my eyes to prevent shampoo from seeping in, but I was having none of it. I screamed and yelled and cried, and in a moment of what can only be described as sheer frustration, my mother brought her arms down, and the wet cloth came unfolded and struck me across the cheek. That's the moment that I stopped crying.
Gasp.
And my mother started crying. She hadn't meant for it to happen. Even at four, I knew that, but she was devastated. Of course, there were intentional hits, smacked hands to warn me to put down the cookie, to stay away from the filthy ashtray, and whacks on the backside as I whizzed down the hall, around the banister, and up the stairs to my bedroom, a direct result of my smart mouth that never knew when to quit.
This is a remarkable glimpse into life in Canada.
It is.
I can envision all these children with long chestnut hair asking, "Mom, may I please watch the curling match? No, I'm going to hit you with a hockey stick, eh?"
These were punishments delivered by parents who believe that sometimes a short, sharp message is what it takes to get a child's attention. I don't consider that abuse. I consider it discipline, but I'm sure the researchers would disagree. The study looked at three different categories: being slapped in the head, face, or ears, or being hit with something hard a minimum of three times, being grabbed, pushed, or shoved, or having something thrown at them a minimum of three times.
Well, what's this minimum of three times
stuff? I don't know why
stuff.
The three times thing.
Yeah.
I don't understand where the study comes in. And being kicked, bit, punched, burned, or physically attacked at least once. Okay, that's bad.
That's bad, yeah.
That's bad.
You can bite your kid once, but whack him two and a half times. You know, it's not the same, I guess.
And so although there was never anything even close to the kind of physical attack outlined in their criteria, I'd squeak into their category of abused child. By the same token, I would also be an abuser. When I can't, and this is this woman talking, not me, by the way.
Okay.
When I can't drum up a single specific incident of pulling my daughter away from something other than danger, which doesn't count, I can tell you with near certainty that I did. I'm sure I gave her a tap or two on the hand, and I know I spanked her backside. What I can tell you for certain is each of the times I used corporal punishment, it was in those moments that I failed most as a parent.
We should make sure that, you know, having learned from War of the Worlds that you have to have frequent notices in there that you were reading from somebody else, because if someone tuned in like right at the moment that you're talking about,
I know,
whacking,
and I don't want
somebody
that to be.
So just like Orson Welles should have done, this is a reenactment of a statement.
I'm
that
reading
you,
an
you
article
just heard.
You're, called
he's
spanking
reading an
your
article.
Kids doesn't make you you a child abuser.
You know, we just talked about this
Post.
A couple of weeks ago, but obviously the fact that this we're seeing more and more articles here, it's something that's becoming, you know, more controversial, I guess. I mean, it's always been controversial, but we do have a statute in Wisconsin that permits a parent within reason to exercise corporal punishment if the purpose of doing so is involved with what we regard as appropriate parenting. So you can hit your child, it just can't be too hard. Unfortunately, and I have strong views on this just because it's one of those laws where it comes down to the opinion of the person that has the report sitting on their desk. And if you happen to be somebody that believes that no one should have any physical contact at all with their child, and there are plenty of people out there that believe that, and that no amount of disciplinary procedure is appropriate, then you know, your personal views of what you think is appropriate, especially when things are in writing without the true circumstances of the situation being accurately reflected. So I think this is one of those things where, and we see it all the time, someone gets charged with child abuse based on a report, and that's based on how the officer got the information, which sometimes is, you know, Joey goes to school the next day, tells Sammy that mommy hit me last night, and then the school counselor gets called in, then the cops get called in, then the parents get called in, then it's blown out of proportion. By that point, we have no idea what really happened because, right, you know, maybe the kid had no intention of turning the parents in or anything like that. And then the person gets charged with a felony. They got to go out and hire a lawyer. They got to go through this whole rigmarole. Forever now, they're deemed somebody that was accused of something like
but
this.
But you cut a balance with this, Kirk, because you can't obviously – and you're right. I mean, if it's a simple spanking that's not – unreasonable.
Right. And you know what? A 4-year-old is not supposed to like being spanked.
No.
So
nobody likes being spanked.
They're going to not like it.
But we can't have a situation where somebody is abused, abused. I mean, that would be a terrible scenario. So,
right.
So where do you draw the line? I mean, I think this is a hard law to draw. I mean, you say that it has to be, and the law says it has to be reasonable,
well,
right? What does it mean to be reasonable?
Well, that's the problem. That's what I'm saying.
So how do you actually
practice law? We know when something is way into that realm of unreasonable. I mean, if you're bruising your child or the kid's bleeding because of discipline, obviously that's not reasonable. But it's all of the myriad of things that can lead up to that one person would view it as too much and another wouldn't.
Okay, I have been spanked as a child on a number of occasions,
mm-hmm,
and I remember, you know, if you're spanked on your bare behind, you're going to have a red mark there.
Right.
Does that constitute abuse?
Because
you just talked about if somebody has a bruise.
Well, severe bruising, I guess, is what I would
probably
say.
What?
Severe bruise. I don't know.
Well, what does that mean?
It's subjective.
That's what I'm asking.
That's my problem with the whole thing. But let me just take you back a few steps.
I feel like we're doing who's on first here.
I don't know. He's on third. Well, here's another problem with this whole scenario. When you think about why a child is being disciplined, and if you just want to use the words from this Huffington Post article where the woman is talking about, you know, with her chestnut hair and all this stuff, and how she recognizes that she was being a child, and children are act as children oftentimes, and sometimes, when appropriate, a parent has an obligation to correct that behavior, and because of the lack of maturity, you can't have a sit down logical discussion where you draw a Venn diagram for a 4-year-old. And sometimes to get that child's attention and to make a memorable impact, there has to be some form of contact there.
Did you get spanked as a
child? Oh, absolutely.
Are you glad that you did?
Yes. I mean, now I am. Back then, and here's my point. When you're 4 and you're misbehaving like all 4-year-olds do, and then you're corrected by your parent, naturally, you're upset about that and you feel wronged because you're 4. And then you're going to tell people, I wanted some cookies from the cookie jar, and I got spanked, and it's unfair.
But wait a minute. What about, let's say this, okay? I just want to get where
and
the
then they have
is.
The parents, you know, prosecuted for the whole thing. You know what happens? Then the 4-year-old just becomes a bad 5-year-old.
Right, right. Well, okay. But what happens, though, let's say in this scenario, because you never talked, it seems to have gotten progressively sort of less severe, because I remember, you know, talking to people in older generations,
sure,
and they'd say, my father used to, you know, put me over the chair and I'd have a leather strap that he would come out and he'd whack me with that leather strap, or he'd hit me with a piece of plywood or whatever. I mean, doesn't that border on the unreasonableness?
Sure. Sure. Or like, you know, I'm expecting that parents shouldn't be using tasers on their kids or anything like that.
Right, right.
And so that's obvious.
The point is, though, it's a difficult line to draw. And if you're saying that there is some corporal punishment that is allowed and other corporal punishment that is not allowed.
Right.
When you take your case to, let's say, a jury,
yeah,
a lot of that is going to depend on the jury's views,
right,
is reasonable and their experience.
And they're not the parent of your kid.
They're not the parent of your kid.
But here's another thing. When it comes down to, as I mentioned before, somebody in a prosecutor's office reading a report and saying, should we pull the trigger on this one or not? I think there's a tendency in our society to go ahead and pull the trigger and charge these people. And we're taking away what in many cases is an appropriate parental response and negating that parent's authority over this child forever. And in many ways, prosecuting these types of cases can have a profound impact on that parent-child relationship when, in fact, in many of these cases, there was nothing wrong with it and it was entirely appropriate, societally, it's acceptable, But it's just one of those things that, you know, we fear those cases where the father is using a piece of plywood or, you know, or a stick with a nail in it or something crazy like that. And of course, you know, that gets all of us angry. Right. But I think what we see in some cases is the ghost of a worse case, and we want to do what we can to prevent child abuse. I want to do everything I can to prevent child abuse.
Right, as do I.
I'm a member of society, and that's important to me. But this is a problem. This is a big problem that we deal with.
Absolutely. All right, we'll be back with the final segment of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. Hey, do you remember this song from the Meatloaf album, All Revved Up with No Place to Go?
Yes.
That's kind of how I feel right now.
Because you've got your coffee.
I got my jet fuel coffee, and the words are just flying out of my mouth. I have no idea what I talked about in that last segment.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, that's...
Caffeine has taken over.
Caffeine has taken over, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court is set to decide... a few cases regarding drunk driving, and specifically, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, according to the Associated Press, is set to decide whether police can legally draw the blood of a suspected drunk driver without a warrant or the consent of the driver. Now, you and I know that there was a case that came down last year called Missouri versus McNeely that basically said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but in a nutshell, hey, just because you've stopped somebody for drunk driving and you suspect them to have been drunk driving, you could not just take their blood without a warrant or without their consent or without what we call exigent circumstances in a routine drunk driving case. And even though there's this natural dissipation of alcohol over time that we all know about, that's not good enough to supersede
not
the
anymore.
Requirement to get a warrant anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, the history of this is fascinating because it's a very good example of one sentence changing history or changing the course of history. And I'm going to take you back to a time when Tiny Tim was tiptoeing through the tulips.
Oh, boy.
When the Beatles were still together. When, you know what I'm getting at. It's
yes.
the 60s.
Yes.
1966, as a matter of fact. There was a case called Schmerber versus California. And the issue in the case, it dealt with several issues, but the primary surviving impact of the Schmerber case is that due to... the possibility of the rapid dissipation of alcohol in a person's system, it may create an exigency where the police do not necessarily need a warrant. And I've paraphrased, but I think I've captured the gist of it pretty well. That sentence in the Schmerber decision was then utilized by every state in our country and the federal government to redefine what's required in a drunk driving case. And when they say it may be needed because it's possible that they don't need a warrant, that was converted to you never need a warrant because it's always an exigency. And just so you know, exigency is one of those legal terms we use, but the best definition in lay terms is emergency. An exigency is an emergency. So it's so critical that you have to drop everything and get the blood as fast as possible. And you couldn't possibly stop to get a warrant. Now, some wise guy and I mean wise guy in a good way, a guy that was wise, not the other kind of wise guy, but this guy, McNeely, okay? He goes through the entire Missouri court system making the argument that, hey, guys, go back and read that sentence to see what it actually says in the 1966 Supreme Court opinion. And you know what? They did. And they said, oh, my golly, you're right. It doesn't say that in every single case you don't need a warrant. And it talks about what exigencies are. Then the Missouri Supreme Court agreed as well. And the government appealed and got it to the Supreme Court. And ultimately, McNeely wins on, right. on a theory that that simply relies on being able to know the difference between maybe and definitely. And, right. you know, I learned that difference when I was in grade school. I didn't have to go to law school to learn those things. And the entire country for 40 years ignored that difference.
And lots of people are, some people are complaining about this decision. It's still in Missouri versus McNeely saying, oh, this is going to create chaos because now that we need a warrant to take somebody's blood.
Why? Because our Supreme Court reminded us that we have
that we have a warrant requirement. I know. I agree with you. I'm just saying the pessimists against this are saying, well, this is going to be too difficult. And how are a lot of drunk driving arrests are made at, 2 a.m. or 1 a.m. And how are judges going to sign these warrants? Well, they've found ways. They have electronically submitted warrants in many counties where it's basically a mail it in. It's a phone call in the middle of the night, which may be inconvenient, but that's too bad when it comes to the Constitution.
You hit it on the head because that's the real controversy here from the inside and the underworld of how justice works. Judges don't want to get they don't want to have to wake up at 2 a.m. to authorize a warrant. That's what it comes down to.
I don't blame him for not wanting
to.
Well,
come on.
I don't blame him for not wanting to, but I'm saying it's part of the Constitution.
You know, if you're dealing, if you have any involvement in criminal law, and I'm saying this is a bad thing that, that judges are expressing this concern, but if you have any involvement in criminal law, whether you're a defense lawyer, a police officer, a prosecutor, a detective, a judge, any of those things, we deal with stuff in the middle of the night.
Absolutely.
That happens.
All the time. You and I get calls.
My phone rings at 1 a.m.
Absolutely.
You know?
All the time. And we have to, and it's not to say, well, we have to deal with it, so you should too. But it is to say that in this world of criminal justice that we live in, things happen at all hours of the night. And when you balance an inconvenience to a particular person who might have to sign a warrant or might have to review whether a warrant ought to be authorized in a particular case, you balance that against somebody's constitutional right not to have the government, because by that way, that's what this is, the government shoving a needle into your arm.
Right.
Which is by, I think, all accounts, well, it is a search, number one.
Oh, yeah.
And is certainly, in my view, an unreasonable search unless you have their consent or unless you have exigent circumstances or unless you have an actual warrant. And I keep putting these phrases on things. It's not like it's all that hard now to find an exception to the warrant requirement. It's basically been
erroneous. There are many more exceptions than there are,
Yeah. But that basic requirement, do you think the founding fathers, when they envisioned the Fourth Amendment and how it was supposed to be, how it was supposed to go into effect, would have said years later, yes, you can shove a needle in somebody's arm as long as you suspect them of drunk driving without a warrant?
We should go back and look and see if anything in the Federalist Papers or anything to talk about somebody riding a horse in the middle of the night and they're suspected of possessing tea without a tax stamp or something, and the sentry pulls him over and says, "Sir, I would like to stick a quill into one of your veins and draw some bodily fluid so that we can test for the presence of tea in your system." I don't know why I have that silly British accent. Do you envision that the colonists still had English accents? Or
I kind of do. Yeah.
Yeah, I do too. But did you ever see Gangs of New York?
No.
Which is it's in the early 1700s, before the Revolution, I believe. I don't know. It's been a while since I've seen it. And they're all talking like New Yorkers, like this, hey, yo, hey, bada bing, bada boo.
Boy, that was very interesting. Kirk, now, you interrupted my rant.
I'm sorry.
I was going on a rant.
You're entitled to your rant, too.
I was trying to rant.
All right.
I'll sit back.
In fact, I'm going to sit back away from the microphone.
No, I just say this with all sincerity, because this does trouble me greatly. This whole idea that we have this reaction. And again, I get it. I don't like having to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning either. I don't like having to do that. But it is part of my duty. It's part of my duty as providing justice to people, as providing a service to people, as defending their freedoms, as defending their constitutional rights. And judges and prosecutors have that same duty to adhere to the Constitution. And when we have, I feel like I'm on a political speech right now.
Oh, yeah.
But when we have this
I'm voting for this guy.
when we have this idea that you can just do this because we have a problem with drunk driving. Do we have a problem with drunk driving? Yes, we do. It's a problem. Nobody likes drunk driving. But we also have our constitutional rights to be protected, and they ought to be honored and protected. And nobody ought to say that just because it could be an inconvenience to somebody, that that's enough to override the need to get a warrant in a case where clearly the United States Supreme Court has said you need a warrant unless there is an exception to that or consent.
Right.
And by clearly, I think the wording and the intent behind the Fourth Amendment would so prohibit this, so prohibits this in every way. But it's just an example of something where we need not to get, I don't know what the right word to call it, but complacent when it comes to the Fourth Amendment.
But that's what happened over the years. And here's, if we really just talk about basics in terms that everybody can understand, a routine traffic stop and in a routine drunk driving arrest should involve routine procedures. And where we start with a Fourth Amendment analysis is a warrant is required. That's routine.
That's right.
And do you ever wonder, I mean, I know this is a little more esoteric, but there is no exception to the warrant requirement listed in the Fourth Amendment. These are all things that were created philosophically over the years through Supreme Court decisions.
And there's no drunk driving exception in the Fourth Amendment,
right.
Although it certainly feels like that sometimes, doesn't it?
It does.
It's an unfortunate thing. Okay. All right. Well, now that we've ended on that note, we want to remind you that you can listen to us live every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. You can also listen to our podcasting at any time. And that's been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a wonderful weekend.